The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bjorkman, Judge Frisch, Judge Kirk, the Honorable Luis Dovre Bjorkman presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is March 24th, 2022. We are pleased to proceed this morning with three oral arguments. This is the first of them. It is the matter of In Re, the determination of the need for environmental impact statement for Pavilion Estates subdivision. I know that counsel are familiar with our rules. You will each have 15 minutes to present your argument. Counsel for the relators will have an extra 5 minutes for rebuttal. I understand Mr. Reavers will be presenting arguments on behalf of both respondents, so there is no need to switch time. Is that accurate, Mr. Reavers?
It is, Your Honor.
Wonderful. And we are familiar with the case. We've read everything. And so I would encourage you to get right to the heart of your arguments with the limited time frame. And I will also remind everyone that no recordings of this proceeding are permitted. With that, counsel for relators, you may proceed.
May it please the court. I'm James Peters, counsel for relators, attending the hearing today via Zoom. Maybe members of Appellants Save the Rookery as well. Allow me to please first summarize the four arguments that I plan to address this morning. First, this appeal involves the nominal standard for an environmental impact statement based upon an EAW. Not that the project will definitely have potential effects, but that the project has the potential for significant environmental effects. The legislature purposefully established this standard to screen out simple EAWs, because the EAW is just a brief document on a short, simple form. Second, the court has to reverse here because the township made several errors of law, and the courts often reverse EAW determinations when there's a legal determination that's been then goofed up. Here, the township made a number of errors, and we'll highlight those in the argument, but basically they certified an amended EAW and then they didn't publish it. It had 80 new pages of information. The rules require publication and input. They relied on a prohibition rule violation by the county, and they actually helped facilitate that. The EAW failed to have a discussion of compliance with land use controls and other things that are required by the form, and they didn't have some other information from state agencies that was required. Third, there's another set of combination of danger signals that what the township did here was not engaging in reasonable decision making, but was in fact being willful. They basically rubber stamped the developer's findings with basically a consent agenda entry at their meeting of September 9th, where there was basically no discussion. And that's particularly troubling with the 80 pages of new information. Finally, the court, they didn't take a hard look at the essential issues that related to this, the rookery in particular. The relators had the testimony of Mr. Henderson, who's probably the leading expert on this issue in Minnesota. Mr. Henderson was harshly critical of the project's submissions on the EAW and their expert, Mr. Gordon. And unfortunately, Dr. Gordon, unfortunately, the township did not at all evaluate his experience, practical experience, or his qualifications to give any opinions. Dr. Gordon is actually specializes in wind energy projects in Latin America. So that's an overview. With that, I'll turn to the four arguments. First, on the standard for an EAW, we have the CARD case.
Mr. Peters, can I just kind of cut to the chase? I mean, I understand your argument that that the township should have required a whole nother EAW public comment process once it received the supplemental EAW from the respondent. But part of me, I just don't understand what that would accomplish. I mean, isn't the responsible government agency supposed to, in fact, look at all the information that's developed during the EAW process, including changes or modifications a developer proposes in response to public comments? What's the point of reopening it yet again?
It's a good question. Why should the township have on September 9th reopened the public comment period, republished it on that amended EAW from September 7th? And the answer is that the environmental review process is intended to be like a three-legged stool. There's the public, there's the project, and then there's a responsible government unit. And so Rule 4410, 1400, they place a lot of emphasis on public input and public comment and the involvement of the public in the EAW process. That's an essential part of the EAW process by the statute and the rules. And so why, when you have 80 new pages of information and the basic EAW form is only about 15, so the township stuffed the record with a whole bunch of new information, including an entire new section on greenhouse grass.
Let me stop you there. Isn't the amended EAW something that the respondents prepared?
They did, correct. But most critically, the township certified that. The township is responsible under the rules to certify the accuracy and the completeness of an EAW. And that's what they did here. It's in the record at AR 762. The township essentially adopts the EAW and certifies the accuracy and completeness of that information. And then that certification is what then triggers the public notification. So the developer provides the information and the data, but the RGU is responsible for certifying its accuracy and completeness. And that's just an administrative official who does that. It's not the whole town board. And so the cases that the respondents rely on, the Mankato Motorsports Park and Living Word, those cases do not involve a new certified EAW. They involve additional information, which is common. I mean, it's obvious that, you know, when they get the public input in, they'll add some more information, try to figure out what's in the record and try to adjust it. But what's different here is what happened in the Catalpa Ag situation with the MPCA, which I provided to the court in our brief, is they actually felt that they certified the EAW with all the new information. And that's what triggers right on the form, page 762 of the record. It says this is for publication and public input. And so the public didn't get allowed to comment on the whole new section on greenhouse gases. They didn't get to comment on a completely rewritten section on cumulative effects and the appendices that were added to this supplemental EAW.
So, can I just ask Proby a little bit there? So there's a spectrum, right, of potential amendments, right? So there could be corrections of typographical errors on one end and a completely brand new document on the other end. And we're somewhere in the middle here. And I'm just trying to figure out as a matter of law or what the legal principle is for when republication would be required when where on that spectrum. Are you saying like you would have to republish for typographical errors? I mean, where are we?
So yeah, the good question, you know, when should they have to redo the public process? They don't have to do it for every comma and every period, right? And the question is, where are we on the spectrum and when do they have to do that? I think the critical issue for the court on this is the recertification by the township and then the reliance on that amended and updated EAW in their findings and conclusions. So if you look at the addendum, pages 3 and 5, the township relied upon the amended EAW as updated for their decision, for their findings. And so I'd say that's the difference. You know, the law clearly says, the rule says, you know, when you certify a new EAW, you have to publish it and take public input. That's the law. And law and equity calls the court to look at the law and the facts. And here we have the law says publish and take input and factor that input into the decision. And the facts here show that they certified an amended EAW, then they relied on that amended EAW for their decision.
Well, they relied on a lot of things. I mean, I think they relied on the reports of staff and all of the public comments. I mean, there were all kinds of comments. They relied on responses from state agencies. you know, if the developer here, rather than submitting a supplemental EAW, had simply said, we're modifying our application in this regard, I mean, you wouldn't have this legal argument. And as a practical matter, are we in any different position in terms of what the township looked at when it made its determination that no EIS was necessary?
Well, I think, you know, it goes back again to the spectrum of information. The question is, you know, how significant was this information? Is it a comma, a period, or is it a whole rewrite of entire sections of the EAW? And clearly on this record, if you look at these facts, if you look at what they added to this EAW, you'll see extra 80 pages. You'll see an entire section on cumulative effects that's completely rewritten. And that's a significant part of an EAW. The Card case reversed and wrote 20 pages of opinion on how to distinguish cumulative effects from cumulative impacts. And so this EAW has they missed on greenhouse gas emissions the first time. And so they added an entire new section on that. Well, the public didn't get comment or input on it. And that, you know, if you're going to apply the rule, there's no exception in the law that says, in some cases, we can ignore the rule. You know, if we don't feel like this is a significant question, we can ignore the rule that requires publication. You know, what distinguishes
Council, the greenhouse gas emission issue is not a particularly compelling question. I mean, if you're going to have 12 residential lots and you're going to have 12 residences, they're going to produce a certain amount of a carbon footprint or whatever you want to call it. It isn't anything unusual in particular. If you're talking about a subdivision and you're looking at the number of homes on it, that's something that's done regularly.
Well, it's kind of like if you had a criminal case. I hear what you're saying. You know, you're saying that a subdivision by itself is not like the Daily Farms feedlot that was going to independently equal 19th largest methane emission in the state. That's different from that. And I agree with you that it is different. But that doesn't change it doesn't give the court a pass to say that we're going to ignore the rule that requires republication. We're just going to sweep that under the rug and say that this was harmless foul. You know, it's no harm, no foul. We're not going to follow the law in this case. It's not equitable to the parties, and it's not good precedent to take key facts like a certified amended EAW and focusing just on one part of it, the greenhouse gas emissions, but you really need to look also at the cumulative effects part. I think to be equitable to the parties, you got to apply the law.
Wasn't the main change, though, to reduce the number of trees that would be taken down or forests that would be impacted from 17 acres to 5 or whatever it was?
Well, that's a slightly different issue. I think what you're asking about is, you know, did the project change in response to the comments as compared to the analysis change and the public input change? Yes, there were some changes to the project, but the project was never adequately described. And so the details of the main issues that pertain to the trees, the roadway, impervious surface runoff, those issues were never addressed. There's a problem with the compliance with this project, with the local land use controls, and the approval of the GDP is on appeal right now in the district court.
It seems to me, one of the questions I have, Mr. Peters, is what's the scope of our review? I mean, we're just talking about the negative declaration, right? I mean, the question about whether ultimately the county, violated the prohibition rule, or whether the county's decision to permit this, grant this application is sound. I mean, that's not before us in this case, is it?
Well, yes, it is. I think the county's prohibition rule example for their violation on May 18th of granting it approval, which respondents still don't concede is a decision that's covered by the rules. They're still arguing for an exemption in their briefs, which is wrong. But what it is it's a danger signal that the township is not engaging in reasonable decision-making and that they're doing an arbitrary decision. And so in the Pope County Mothers case, what you had is the MPCA had a multi-site feedlot, And the MPCA had issued three permits to parts of it in violation of the prohibition rule. And Stevens County had issued a permit to one part of it in violation of the prohibition rule. And the Court of Appeals in that case said that, look, this is a these are danger signals that the agency is not following the rules. They're not following the law, and we need to send this back for either a new EAW to review and a remand for review of what they did, or as they did in Polk County Mothers, just a flat out order for an EIS. It's because these are danger signals that the court looks to. So, you know, the violation of the prohibition rule, the incompleteness of the EAW discussion of these land use controls, the rubber stamping of the findings on a consent agenda item with no discussion. Those are all things that are factors that the court must consider. These are the legitimate factors that the courts consider on EA determinations. And so that's why I think they have to be accounted for here and not just look the other way. I see my time is up. Unless you have other questions, I'll save my 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you for your attention.
All right. Seeing no questions, we will wait to hear from you on rebuttal. Mr. Reavers, you may proceed with your argument on behalf of the respondent.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Paul Reavers appearing on behalf of Rochester Township. The township here took the requisite hard look at this 10-unit or 10-lot low-density residential development and determined it did not have the potential for significant environmental effects. That decision was reasonable based on substantial evidence in the record and fully in accord with the rules. We ask the court to affirm that determination. I think the starting point for any of these cases is the standard of review, obviously a very deferential standard of review for the responsible governmental unit. This is a full record. It's kind of ironic that an EAW is described as a brief document because you look at this record, this is a very substantial record evaluating a whole host of issues. And the township did take a hard look at this. And if you look at the plaintiffs or the relator's approach to this, 44 pages of their 49-page opening brief was procedural based. We've got 5 pages on substantive environmental issues. And I think we got to look
at Mr. Reavers, it seems to me that procedural posture, procedural history is significant. I mean, one of the relators most fervently argued points is that, in fact, the township didn't follow the rules, that when you have an amended EAW, the rules require public comment and an opportunity to be heard, and that by violating that rule, in fact, the township acted in a way that is arbitrary and to which we should not defer. How do you respond to that?
Number one, the rules don't say that. The 4410, 4410, 1500, none of these rules cited by the respondent suggests that when there's a change to an EAW, it triggers a new process, new public hearing, a new process. And I would cite the court. So number one, the rules don't require that. Number two, the courts addressed the situation in the Mankato Sports Park case, that when there's changes to the project, that does not trigger new environmental comment period or review, particularly when it's done to address these concerns. You know, and that's what this court said in Mankato Sports Park case, that, wait a minute, when the city is based on changes that decrease the potential for significant environmental impacts, that's not an arbitrary and improper decision. That is in accord with the rules. And that's what happened here. And that's why I think you started out with the question, you know, let's look at where do we really go? What do they get? The big picture here is there's a substantial reduction in the removal of trees and forestation, you know, down to 5.94 acres on this massive site. That's how this process is supposed to work, right? The developer obtains.
Mr. Reavers, can I just ask, is there any situation where an amendment would trigger a republication and comment period? I mean, we're talking about a spectrum, right? Typographical errors to a complete rewrite. Mm-hmm. If we're on complete rewrite territory, is it your position that there's still no need for there's still no requirement for republication and comment?
I think under the circumstances here, certainly not. I think the only rules that even reflect, discuss a potential new EAW is in Minnesota Rule 4410-1000, subpart 5. And that's entitled Change in Project, New EAW. And basically, after there's been a negative declaration, if the RGU determines that a substantial change has been made to the project, which may affect the potential for significant adverse environmental effects that were not addressed in the existing EAW, a new EAW is required. So I think that's the framework, right? Now, they say we didn't follow that rule, or the court missed it in Mankato Sports. They didn't. So I think there can be situations where there are significant changes that may trigger that. Mr. Peters alluded to the supplemental EAW that MPCA did in the ag case. And it's unclear why they did that. I think in certain situations, the RGU has a discretion to reopen the public hearing, but by not reopening it does not invalidate that process, particularly when the project is more environmental friendly. I don't think there's any dispute here. And I don't think Mr. Peters can argue that this isn't a better project and more environmentally sound than when it started this process. And again, that's what environmental review is supposed to accomplish at the end. And that's the big picture here. So I would cite the court that there is no rule that requires us to start over when there are amendments and that we agree with those. The certification that the relator continues to point to does not say we shall publish. It certifies it's correct, the information that's contained in there. So we'd be breaking new. I suggest the court would be breaking new ground to require a mandatory, just that every case starts over when there are amendments to it, amendments that change and reduce the size of the project, which is what happened here.
Mr. Reavers, let me ask you this. Mr. Peters argues that the township did not take a hard look at the issues here because, in mm-hmm. fact, it approved the supplemental EA. Well, it made its negative determination following a board meeting during which it had no discussion on its rationale and set forth no indication that it had considered all of the information submitted to it. How do you respond to that?
In the town board has a professional staff, and I'll point the court and staff looked at the EAW and staff made findings. I'll point the court to, in the record, AR 1015, the staff report. And the staff report starts on 1012. I think that's always a good starting point for the court. But I'll quote, Rochester Township staff has determined that the EAW should be corrected, as pointed out by several comments, both the public and regulatory agencies. So the professional staff that the township had did ensure that this thing was thoroughly vetted, and the town board is certainly entitled to rely on its staff in making a determination that, and so based on the information that staff had put together, certainly in the extensive record, the town board wasn't required to do more than it did here. And it adopted specific findings that allow meaningful judicial review by this court. And so there's nothing wrong with incorporating the work that the developer did to address each and every concern raised by the relators here. And so that's from the procedural standpoint. This is spot on. We followed the rules, and Mankato Sports demonstrates that nothing more was required under certainly on this record, and certainly what happened here. And again, if you look at the title of that, amended to respond to public comments is the title of that, is which is the actual amendment. And that's all of the information, like why we, I think I heard stuff the record. The idea is to respond. So the fact that the issues were adequately addressed, that greenhouse gases and climate change weren't addressed as thoroughly as they should have been, they should be happy. Now they have been. That's part of the process. There's not a, the legislature did not set up a process. This is not a situation where they get to look at every response or how we got there. That's what the public comment period is for. And so that's from a procedural standpoint, certainly thoroughly vetted. Prohibition rule just doesn't apply. I mean, give me a break. The county is not the township, number one, and approving a zoning change is not a permit to begin a project. I always look at that as, are you giving authorization to put a shovel in the ground? That's certainly not what the county did, but to the extent that the relators have a concern with the county, they can challenge that separately. So that simply doesn't apply here. I want to touch, I mean, really, what is this case really about? You know, why are we here? It's really about the rookery. And we haven't heard a whole lot about that, but other than they had an expert, and it wasn't the township's expert. The developer had a reputable expert and opined that there was, this isn't the only place for the rookeries. One thing I would tell the court to look at the figure 16, I think is a really important looking at. This is not the only place where blue herons reside. In fact, the record shows that the majority of them are on the adjoining properties. But again, the township gets to weigh the evidence. The township gets to say, hey, look at this, great blue herons. It's a migratory bird. It's not threatened. It's not endangered. There are certainly other places that those birds reside. They are adaptable. I think I saw that they are, they're in 13 of the 18 townships in Olmsted County, and this is on the record page, AR-741. And great blue herons breed in 83 of the 87 counties in Minnesota. That's in the record as well. So the county certainly, and when we're looking at reducing the cover of, you know, we're down to 5.494 acres of deforestation, that's a good thing. So the board certainly had a reasonable basis that studying more, you know, there wasn't a need for an EIS on that basis. And similarly with the forest fragmentation, same thing.
Council, there was some record though that there has been a decline statewide in the number of blue herons, particularly in the last 20 years. How do you address that, or do you address that?
Oh, I think it's depend. You can look at that different ways. I think there's evidence in the record. If you look from the 1940s to the present, it's a greater number now. But I think that they're not an endangered species. There's certainly other places. This isn't the only place that great blue herons can reside. And we're not talking about the whole property. That's why I think it's important to look at that figure 16 in the record to see what a small area that we're actually talking about. And that the developers taking into consideration that, wait, there are not going to be any construction activities or trees won't be felled, when they're subject to the Migratory Bird Act. So I think the fact is a migratory bird alone is not sufficient to trigger more. I think the evidence shows, and I think we've kind of ticked off in our brief all of the items that the township could determine there more did not need to be done concerning this issue alone.
Council, are you familiar with any project in Greater Minnesota that involved this number of residential units on a parcel of land this big, where an EIS was ever ordered?
No, I mean that's
I have trouble with this idea that this is a significant environmental impact project. It's not a gravel pit. It's not a Enbridge pipeline. It's not a refinery.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I look at environmental impact statements are in Developers Council kind of cited to, I believe it was Justice Anderson's concurrence in Carr, just talking about the massive cost. And when there really isn't environmental issues at stake, I look at, EIS is for gravel pits, as you mentioned. marginal lakeshore conceivably, you know, for massive developments. I've never seen anything in my career that would trigger an EIS for something of this limited nature, particularly where the developer has listened and adapted the project to, I mean, this is, again, a good thing. We're down to 5.94 acres. That addresses climate change. The more hardy trees that can be left on the site certainly are good for the environment, good for addressing those concerns. I think we've gone through, I can walk through all the other things that we briefed all of these things extensively here. To the extent that I did not address anything specifically, I'll rely on the comments that I made in our brief. And also just in the findings, the township did a thorough job of adopting findings that gives the court a sufficient basis to hold those findings up against the record. And on this record, there is more than substantial evidence. And in light of the deferential standard of review, I do ask that the court affirm the township's denial of the request for an EIS. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Peters, you have the last word.
Thank you. Again, James Peters for Relators. I would like to focus the reply basically on the environmental issues. I think we've covered the procedural issues. I do believe those are more the focus of the court's involvement on these appeals because that's the court's role, is to review the law. But there's been a question raised, well, why didn't you bring up more? So I want to emphasize that a little bit right now. First of all, in our formal brief, starting at page 45, we do summarize the public comment and that of Mr. Henderson. He's never observed any other colony in an upland forested site. So he's saying this is very unique. And so in terms of size, I kind of think of the difference between, you know, size, does size matter? Well, yes, but, you know, a lump of coal is the same size as a diamond or a sapphire. Are they of equal value? No, because it's not simply a matter of measuring the acreage or the number of buildings going on a site. It's talking about the location. And if the court's concerned about the scope of an EIS, then it has the option of remanding it back for an additional publication on the EAW. The court, you know, that's not clear in the rules, by the way, but the Supreme Court in Card remanded for additional work on the EAW rather than an EIS. And that solves all the issues that Mr. Reavers has raised about the cost of an EIS, et cetera.
So if we were to follow that approach, Mr. Peters, what specifically would you have us direct the township to do on remand?
Well, I believe that the remedy here would be to reverse and remand for republication or publication of the amended certified EAW and taking a public input and then coming up with, you know, having a meeting to make decision based upon that. After you've had the public input, after that's been reviewed by staff and hopefully by the board this time instead of the rubber stamp. And I don't cite cases from federal court a lot in the state court, but the Snell versus Bell helicopter case I cited specifically talks about rubber stamping staff findings. And it'd be one thing if the town board had gone into some discussion, but it was a consent agenda item with absolute, I didn't see anything in the minutes at all. And so the other thing the court could do is caution the township that, look, if you're going to be considering expert opinions, you know, this is administrative appeal. It's section 1469 and the contested case appeal provisions apply. And the court has a role for abuse of discretion review of the proceedings. And when you're talking about an expert, you check on his qualifications and his practical experience. Mr. Henderson was sharply critical of the EAW. And just take for a moment and consider, what if he's right? What if Mr. Henderson is correct that the EAW, quote, misinterpreted data? And this is at the record at 427 to 432. It misinterpreted data. It's a significant exaggeration, a totally false interpretation of the data. The credibility of this EAW is therefore seriously flawed with misinformation and inaccuracies. the EAW includes erroneous conclusions. Now, if Mr. Henderson is right, then this thing is seriously flawed. Now, the township relied on Mr. Gordon's opinion extensively. Broberg is the first expert they brought in. He's a hydrology guy. He does water and groundwater. And in southeastern Minnesota, he's very knowledgeable about the... I actually worked with him on a case involving an ethanol plant in Aota, Minnesota. But here, Mr. Gordon, if you look at his information, he specializes in wind energy projects in Latin America for power companies. I mean, where did they find this guy? And Mr. Henderson was sharply critical of that. And did the township respond to that comment? Did the township say, let's do a little bit of, now they're not bound by a court and rules evidence 702 to verify an expert and do that whole process, but we still are an administrative proceeding and they need to exercise some judgment. I mean, what if it's true that this Dr. Gordon, his primary knowledge is about wind energy projects in South America? There's nothing in the record here that shows that he has any practical experience with southeastern Minnesota or great blue herons or migratory birds. So that's something that I see my time is up. Thank you for your attention to this case. Again, we ask for either an EIS order or a remand for an EAW, further EAW. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peters. Thank you both for your helpful arguments and briefing in this case. We